And welcome once again. This is Richard Klemm. Welcome to our conference call CLE program today on July 18th, and also to those of you who are listening to the podcast online for on-demand credit. Today we're going to be talking about some recent decisions from the Minnesota Supreme Court and the Minnesota Court of Appeals that were handed down in May and June 2014. The next part of this program, which will take place on Monday, the 21st, and also again on the podcast, we'll look at some decisions from the end of May and during the month of June. So you get to hear what the Minnesota appellate courts have been up to. This program, we also have attorneys taking it from other states, so many of these decisions might be of interest to them as persuasive precedents. But today we're going to be focusing on the Minnesota courts. And and you have in your course materials in front of you a list of the cases we're going to be talking about. And if you click on the link for each of those cases, you'll see a little summary of the case. And in that summary, if you want to see the court's actual opinion from the state law library website, you can find it there. But our first case is State v. Moore, and this is one of those cases you look at, and you really have to give a lot of credit to the state public defender's office. They do an excellent job, even when they don't have a lot to work with. And I think it's safe to say that that the Moore case was where the state public defender's office really did their best, even though they didn't have a lot to work with, because. This Mr. Moore called 911 and reported a little domestic disturbance. He said that his wife had attacked him with a knife, and he reported that he had to fight back and engage in a little bit of self-defense. Well, his self-defense story didn't really hold a lot of water because the wife was stabbed 64 times, so it kind of shot his theory of defense right there, because it didn't really look like too much of a legitimate self-defense claim with 64 wounds. You would think he would be able to stop the aggressor with a little bit less than that. But he went to trial, and he was found guilty, and he was found guilty of first-degree murder without the possibility of parole. State Public Defender's Office appealed that, and they said that the evidence did support finding of premeditation, especially from the fact that the knife that had been used was actually a kitchen knife, so he had to actually walk to the kitchen to get this knife before returning to the bedroom. So they held that was sufficient premeditation. And then the other evidentiary issue was that his ex-wife testified as to some earlier abuse situations, and the court held that there was not any error there, or at least it was not reversible error. I'm just going to, for those taking the program live, I'm just going to check my email real quick just to see if there are any questions, and I don't believe there are any. Next case we're going to take a look at also, and that was Minnesota Supreme Court. Incidentally, for those of you from out of state, in Minnesota, first-degree murder convictions bypass the Court of Appeals. They go directly to the Supreme Court. So you occasionally you'll see cases like that. You kind of wonder why the Supreme Court would take a case where there's really no pressing legal issue. Well, in the case of first-degree murder, the Minnesota Intermediate Court of Appeals does not have jurisdiction in those cases. State versus Vang, another conviction of first-degree murder. Basically, he had committed the alleged offense at the age of 14, but was not indicted until the age of 23, and the it would have been a situation where I think pretty clearly based upon the facts of the case is that he would have been certified as an adult. Well, basically the court held that the district court had jurisdiction without having to go through that intermediate step of presenting it to the juvenile court. So kind of a procedural thing if you're ever involved in any juvenile cases where the juvenile is not charged until they are an adult, that's the case to consult. State of Minnesota versus 3M. This is kind of interesting because it's an ethics issue. So we talk about Rule 1.9 and conflicts of interest in our ethics program, which is available as another podcast, incidentally. So if you need your ethics credits, you can talk about that. But normally when we talk about it, part of the ethics program, the construction of Rule 1.9 usually comes up in the context of attorney discipline cases. Well, this case comes up in a little bit different posture because somebody was seeking to have one of the attorneys in the case disqualified because of that conflict of interest. So here the court held that the district court in the midst of a civil case does indeed have jurisdiction to decide the issue of whether or not there's a conflict of interest. And also, interestingly though, they held that the attorney, this is the main holding in the case, I think, that the attorney has independent standing to appeal that. So in this case, the attorney had been disqualified in this civil case. Well, it was the attorney who brought the appeal, and they held that was a proper, it was proper for the attorney to bring the appeal directly. So like I say, it just shows that those ethics rules might present themselves in situations other than complaints for a violation in some kind of attorney discipline case. Moving to sales tax, and this next case, Interstate Traffic Signs, I think it's safe to say on this that if this business would have modified their business plan just ever so slightly, well, they probably would have been able to save their customers some sales tax money, and more importantly for them, I guess, saved themselves having to come up with some arrearages on sales tax that they did not collect. Well, Minnesota has sales tax. For those of you in other states, come up here and do your grocery shopping because we have two things in Minnesota that are not subject to sales tax, and that is food and clothing. So we're taxed on just about everything else here. But that's the one tax advantage there is of being a resident of Minnesota, that you can buy your groceries and buy your clothing without having to pay sales tax. But there's a sales tax on just about everything else, including rentals. Because the statute says that there is a tax imposed on the gross receipts from retail sales, and the definition of retail sales includes rentals. Well, this company, Interstate Traffic Signs, they are the owners of the orange construction signs that you see at work projects. So when a road contractor is working somewhere, they rent the signs from Interstate Traffic Signs. But Interstate Traffic Signs, they have how you do it. It's a package deal. You can't just come in and say, "I want to rent this men working sign," and pick it up yourself. It's always a package deal. You have to have it delivered by them. They deliver it, and then when the rental period is over, they come back and pick it up. And that's mandatory. It's not an option. You can't go in and save on the shipping or anything. Well, they were charging sales tax. They were separately itemizing those on their invoices, though. They were saying one men working sign $25, delivery charge $10, or whatever. So they were charging sales tax only on the rental fee. And they were not charging sales tax on the pickup and delivery fee because they took the position that that was a service. And there is not, well, I guess that's another tax bracket. I believe South Dakota has sales tax on attorney's fees, which I'm glad we don't have here. But in Minnesota, there's no sales tax on services. So they were saying, well, that's a service. We're that's separate from the rental charge. Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court looked at that and said, no, that no matter how you itemize it, it boils down to that if somebody wants to rent that particular sign, they have to pay $35. Doesn't matter how you break it down between the cost of the rental and the cost of the pickup and delivery fees. And I think the I think one of the important facts there was that that is not an optional fee, that that's mandatory, that you have to do it. So I think they could have saved their customers a little bit of money if they would have set it up a little bit differently so that that delivery charge was optional. And if they did have the option to come in and pick them up yourself, then I think they would have been able to make a stronger argument that was not part of the rental fee, that actually was a separate service. Or even if they charged a fee to set up other people's signs or something, then I think they would have had a stronger case. But that's not how they worked it. So if you're engaged in the rental business or even the sales of any kind of a product, I think it does behoove you to separate those two items so that they you can clearly make that argument. At this point, I'm going to go ahead and give our first code word for this portion of the program. And the first code number for today's program is A161, A161, A161 is your first code word. So like I say, at the end of the program, whether you're taking it live or if you're listening to the podcast, email those four numbers to me at clem.law@usa.net, then I will use that to take attendance. And incidentally, even those of you Minnesota, you really don't need my certificate of attendance, but still, please let me know you were here anyway, because I am required to maintain attendance records in the unlikely event that they call me up and ask whether you were here. And if I don't hear from you, I won't know that. So please let me know you were here, even if you don't need any kind of a formal certificate of attendance. Next case from the Minnesota Supreme Court is the commitment of INSEE. This gentleman, this is not quite as moving a set of circumstances as you see in some of these cases. But here, this this is not just a sex offender registry. This is an actual civil commitment. The question was, is he going to be locked up indefinitely? He committed two sexual assaults when he was 17 years old. It sounded like after the first one, he was unrepentant, and it looks like he sorely deserved incarceration for both of those offenses. And he was tried and convicted of two sexual assaults, he was sentenced to 4 years plus 10 years of conditional release. He went through chemical dependency treatment and so forth. It looks like from the facts that we ought to punish our criminals, but you want to give at least some chance to rehabilitate themselves. Well, he served his full sentence, from the facts presented here, it looks like he did a pretty good job of rehabilitating himself and did show some remorse for those earlier issues. He had a job working on a farm. His employer testified that job remained open indefinitely. But the state brought a petition for civil commitment, all the courts held that the burden of proof is on him in that situation to show that he's not likely to reoffend. The burden of proof, the burden is on the state, but the state has to show that it is highly likely that he will reoffend. And even though there's no mathematical number that can be assigned to that, previous cases had held that the words highly likely in the statute kind of means substantially certain. Based upon that, the trial court had applied what it thought was the standard and held that that it was highly likely that he would reoffend. But here the Supreme Court looked at that and said, you know, looking at some of these mitigating factors, maybe the trial court should reassess that. And they provided some clarification. So they remanded it, and so it's possible that this gentleman has a second chance. No second chance, however, for Tony Romanos, who in 2000 committed a very very brutal murder in Washington County. He was 17 years old, 2 months away from his 18th birthday at the time of offense. He was tried as an adult, he was convicted as an adult, and he was sentenced to life without parole. In 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down Miller v. Alabama, in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said it was not a per se violation just to sentence somebody who is a juvenile to life without parole. On the other hand, they gave some very specific considerations that the trial court, that the sentencing court has to look at to decide based upon somebody's age whether they should be sentenced to life without parole. So Mr. In the Miller case, that was sent back to the Alabama courts to consider that. Romanos brought a petition for review based upon that because he was under 18 years old when he committed the crime. He was sentenced to life without parole. The question is whether that case should be applied retroactively. I don't know. If you have that issue come up, I guess I would say this case does not totally foreclose the possibility of retroactive application, but it surely limits it. They held that in his case, he was not entitled to the benefit of the Miller v. Alabama decision. He made one interesting argument though, because the trial court in Washington County had held that the Miller case did apply retroactively, and therefore the trial court had reduced his sentence. So they changed it from life without parole to life with parole after 30 years, I think is what the trial court held. So the trial court had reduced the sentence. Then the state appealed that. The Supreme Court said no. The Washington County Trial Court had erred, and that should not be retroactively applied to his case. Well, his argument then was, basically this is an ex post facto law because my sentence has already been reduced. Here I am with a judgment of the district court saying that I'm eligible for parole in 30 years. So who are you, Supreme Court, to give me a greater sentence? So kind of a strong argument, I would think. But the Supreme Court said, no, we're not reimposing this old sentence. What we are doing simply is vacating or quashing the order that erroneously gave you the lower sentence. They're not reimposing the original sentence. They're reinstating the original sentence, which they held was a different matter. Like I say, that's in his case they held that that case did not have retroactive application, but it's by no means settled because just a few weeks ago the Supreme Court decided another case, State versus Auk. O-U-K, kind of addressed a similar issue. And Mr. Auk was also denied relief, I think it goes to show that issue is still open to a certain extent. So we'll probably see more litigation from people who are sentence to long sentences as juveniles as to the application of Miller v. Alabama. I don't think that's been settled. Well, that kind of wraps up what the Minnesota Supreme Court has handed down in the between mid-April and mid-May. And in addition to that Alk case, like I say, in our next segment of this program, which we'll be doing live on Monday, July 21st, and also as another part of the podcast, we'll be looking at the more recent decisions that came down in May and June from the Supreme Court. But now we turn to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I don't know if we'll be able to get through all of these, but let's see. I guess we'll take a quick look at the Griffin case. This one, if you're going to challenge the composition of the jury panel, you have to come up with some specific evidence. You can't simply show that the percentage of minorities on this jury panel are less than the percentage of minorities in the population as a whole. You have to make that argument a little bit more specific to your case. So here in Olmsted County, he was arguing that the jury panel was all white or mostly white, did not include any minorities, whereas the population of Olmsted County in general did have minorities. But the Court of Appeals said you need to come up with something tailored a little bit more specific to your case. You can't just point to those statistics and expect any relief from that. Collenberg, just a contract construction case. I don't think there's anything too profound in there, they were construing a provision of a purchase contract. The question was, well, you know, it said, it's possible to cancel this purchase contract on the happening of this circumstance. The question in this case was, did that happen automatically, or was the other party required to elect that the contract was canceled? So a pretty straightforward case of contract construction. Let's see. Eisenhower is an unemployment case. Appeals from unemployment cases go directly to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, so you get a lot of fact-intensive unemployment cases before the Court of Appeals because they're required to decide those, and they're really the court of first resort and last resort in making those. Here they're talking about the unemployment law judge's ability to subpoena witnesses, and they make clear that that's discretionary. Just because some party wants to subpoena somebody does not mean that you're automatically going to get it. The unemployment judge has to exercise his or her discretion to see what's going on. We have another whistleblower case. A lot of whistleblower litigation passes through our appellate courts. Ford versus the Minneapolis Public Schools. The question here was, when does the statute of limitations begin to run? And the statute of limitation begins to run when they told her she was going to be fired, even though she continued to work past that date. So they told her, January that at the end of this school year, your contract will not be renewed. The statute of limitations began to run in this case when she was told that in January, not the last day of school. So that's how the statute of limitations is construed in those cases. So if you you have somebody who gets fired, you want to make sure to file as soon as possible. You can avoid statute of limitations arguments by bringing the case promptly. That's usually the best advice in those, I think. That brings us up to about the bottom of the hour here, so I'm going to go ahead and give our second code number. And our second code number for today's program is A232. A232. And I will also just check real quick to see here if there are any questions from our live participants. I don't see any. Sometimes I have the course materials printed out, and I didn't do that today, and I really should because I have to keep changing windows here. I'm just reading them online, as many of you probably are. Moving on to a parental termination case, and basically this case holds that merely because somebody has a low IQ does not mean that they are going to be an unfit parent. This gentleman had an IQ of about 73, but the evidence in the case made clear that he was a responsible citizen. He was he was employed. His boss testified that he operated a sub shop. And the boss told him that, the boss entrusted him with the key to the business, and he was opening up. The gentleman realized that he had problems with parenting, or, he recognized his limitations, and he knew that he could call upon his mother. He knew that the resources that were made available to him by the county. Since he was aware of those resources, he took advantage of those resources. The court held that the mere fact that he had a low IQ is not nearly enough to show that he was an unfit parent, and terminating his parental rights for that reason alone would not be proper. I think they made the right decision there. Those kinds of issues are not the province of the state. Those are the properly decided by the family, especially in that case where he appeared to be very responsible with respect to his obligations. Service of process comes up in the Meeker case and is in as in many many situations there is a there's a statute saying that you can make service of process on an out-of-state corporation by serving the Secretary of State or serving, in this case, the Commissioner of Commerce. This person did that, but that state officer under that statute is required to take some further action. In this case, the Commissioner of Commerce is required to file an affidavit saying that they did serve this person. And in this case, the document was mailed to the summons was mailed to the Commissioner of Commerce within the statute of limitations. However, the Commissioner of Commerce did not take that follow-up step until after the statute of limitations had expired. They did not file the affidavit they were required to. Here the court held that service of process was complete in that case, notwithstanding the fact that the state official did not perform that ministerial act in the time provided. A criminal case, Barrow versus the state of Minnesota. He was charged with a sale of cocaine. The facts here were that he was driving to Rochester to buy some cocaine. That's I guess where you go get cocaine if you're in the Twin Cities. So he drove down to Rochester to get some cocaine. As he was passing through Rice County, he looked in the rearview mirror and he saw some cops. And the cops realized that something suspicious was going on. He probably got a little bit suspicious, or he started acting suspicious when he saw this cop there. So the cops started following him. What he did is he handed the drugs to his wife and said, "Here, conceal these drugs for me, hide them." And she didn't use the drugs. She didn't. She wasn't a druggie or anything like that. But all he did was give them to her, not for the purpose of distributing them to somebody else, but simply for the purpose of evading law enforcement. Well, he was charged not with possession, but with a sale of the substance. And he said, "Well, I didn't sell anything. No money changed hands." Well, the statute doesn't say anything about money changing hands. A gift of drugs constitutes a sale for purposes of the statute. And here they said, "Well, you gave that drug to your wife." The Court of Appeals held that, yes, indeed, that was a sale, even though there was no money changed hands. He ostensibly planned on getting his drugs back. He even tried to make some creative arguments that, this was not a sale, it was a mere bailment. But here, the mere fact that he gave up possession to her was enough to constitute a sale. Really, under that statute, all you need to do to have a sale is to have a transfer of possession. They're not going to look in the fine points of the civil law to see whether it's a sale or a bailment or anything. No, they're just going to look at the definition of sale as contained in that sentence, in the statute. Butler, you got out of you graduated from law school, and you read these you read this International Shoe and Worldwide Volkswagen, and what International Shoe, when was that decided? In the 1930s, I think. So you would think that surely by now, after 80 years of jurisprudence, we would be able to figure out what the minimum contacts are necessary to support personal jurisdiction. But no, I guess we need another 80 years to try to figure it out, because that's still a hotly litigated issue. People still trying to figure out exactly what was said in International Shoe and Worldwide Volkswagen from 1980. Worldwide Volkswagen, if you recall, talked about the stream of commerce theory. Woodson, crashed their defective Volkswagen while driving through Oklahoma. And they decided to sue the supplier, which was Worldwide Volkswagen. Worldwide Volkswagen was just the local dealer off somewhere else. They weren't really worldwide. But this local dealer went into the Oklahoma, I think it was Oklahoma court, and said, "Wait a minute, we've never set foot in Oklahoma. What does that have to do? I'm very sorry, but we don't have jurisdiction here in Oklahoma." Well, the Supreme Court said, "Oh, no, you don't, because you put this car into the stream of commerce, knowing that it would get onto the interstate highways, and one of your cars might find its way to the Sooner State. So therefore, that's good enough for us, and the Oklahoma courts have jurisdiction over you." So like I say, that was decided in 1980, but still, bitterly fought all the way. Well, this gentleman worked, the plaintiff in this case, Mr. Butler, I guess, worked for a company, and he was cleaning off a truck with a pressure washer, and the hose blew up, and he was injured by this hot, high-pressure water. While they traced down the defective component to some little widget that had been made in Israel by the defendant, this Israeli corporation, they made this little valve or whatever it was that failed, but they'd never set foot in Minnesota. They didn't even know where Minnesota was. They didn't have anything to do with this particular valve showing up in Minnesota. In fact, they hadn't sold the valve to a company in Minnesota. They sold the valve to the company that put together the hose. So they sold it to another company in another state, and it was just by pure chance that this particular valve wound up in the state of Minnesota. So they said, surely, even under this this very liberal worldwide Volkswagen standard, surely the Minnesota courts don't have jurisdiction over us, an Israeli corporation, because we weren't selling Volkswagens that can drive on the interstate highways. We were manufacturing these little valves over in Israel. So who'd have ever believed that one of these would wind up in Minnesota? But the Minnesota Court of Appeals looked at the facts of that case, and they said, oh, well, wait a minute, you're selling these to this company that puts together the hoses, and you know full well that the company that assembles the hoses sells their hoses in all 50 states. So surely you would have known that that would wind up in all 50 of the United States, including Minnesota, even if you'd never heard of Minnesota. So the Court of Appeals in that case held that that was sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction, and this Israeli company will have to defend the case in Minnesota court. Now the next one, if you handle traffic cases at all, this issue is bound to come up, and it seems to me there are probably a lot of tickets floating around. This case was decided in April, so maybe they've all been, maybe the time to appeal has expired by now on all these. But it seems to me that this puts a lot of traffic tickets, the validity of a lot of traffic tickets, subject to being set aside. Because here, this was taking place during the potato harvest in Otter Tail County, and the Minnesota State Patrol employed somebody, I think, on a part-time basis, to act as a commercial vehicle inspector. He was a commercial vehicle inspector. He inspected commercial vehicles mostly to make sure that these potato trucks were not overloaded. So he stood there on the shoulder of the county road with an orange sign saying, vehicle inspection point. And when somebody pulled up, when a truck came by, if he thought there were too many potatoes in the back, he signaled them to pull over to the shoulder. And then he had a portable scale, but he weighed them and he inspected everything. He wrote tickets for overweight vehicles. In this case, he pulled this vehicle over and he wrote up a ticket for the weight violation because there were too many potatoes in the back of Mr. Syverson's truck, Stahl, I guess was the name of the defendant. But Mr. Stahl had too many potatoes in the back of his truck. He was overweight, so he wrote him up a ticket for that. And during the course of the stop, he asked the gentleman, can I see your driver's license, please? I don't have a driver's license. It was taken away because I'm inimical to public safety. So the inspector, he called in a sworn state patrol officer who wrote up a ticket or probably did an arrest for driving without a license, not just driving without a license, but driving this overweight potato truck without a license after being found to be inimical to public safety. So it probably was kind of a bona fide stop. But in any event, he paid the fine because he had too many potatoes. But he appealed his separate conviction for for driving without a license. Because this commercial vehicle inspector, under Minnesota law, is not authorized to make traffic stops. So the Court of Appeals held that, everything that happened after the traffic stop, such as can I see your driver's license, that's all invalid because the traffic stop was invalid from the get-go. A commercial vehicle inspector lists the statute here, but Minnesota can employ commercial vehicle inspectors. They don't have to be sworn police officers. And the statute specifies exactly what their duties are. They can write tickets. So the ticket for the overweight truck was okay, but they don't have the powers of a sworn law enforcement officer. So they are not allowed to carry a gun while on duty, and they are not allowed to make traffic stops. So just as a matter of statutory construction, the court held that that ticket was invalid because it arose out of an unlawful traffic stop. Now, I don't know for sure, because when I used to drive 35E, every day on 35E, you would see, there's this big sign right before you get onto 35E, kind of a confusing location. So an out-of-town driver who is not totally familiar with our freeways, I can understand they get to that sign that says no trucks, and unless you know exactly where you're going, there's really no place to turn off. So if you're headed southbound on 35E, when you get to 94, you see that sign at the last minute, and if you see that sign, you realize that, oh, I have to keep going on 94. I can't get on 35E. But I can see a confused out-of-town driver, or maybe somebody not confused just trying to save a couple of minutes, keeps heading south on 35E. And just about every day there's a truck sitting there with it says Minnesota State Patrol Commercial Vehicle Enforcement making traffic stops. At least they were until April 14th, 2014. So it seems to me that if the operator of that squad car is not a sworn police officer, seems to me those tickets are probably invalid. Now, I don't know whether or not they are, because somebody could be in a truck marked commercial vehicle inspector and be a sworn police officer. So I don't know for sure whether that is. But if you do have any cases where the ticket is written by a commercial vehicle inspector, you want to find out. I guess you want to ask the question a little bit more delicately. You don't want to call up the prosecutor and say, was this officer who wrote the ticket, was he a real cop? Don't use the words real cop when you're referring to them. But basically, that's the information you want to find out. You want to find out if that person was a real cop. So you ask, is that a person, a licensed, sworn police officer under Minnesota statute, whatever. That's how you want to phrase the question. But basically, you want to find out if the person is a real cop. And if he's not a real cop, it seems to me that that ticket is invalid under this case. Like I say, that case came from April, so maybe those cases have all worked their way out of the system. But seems to me that probably comes up in more than one case. Moving to the Pollock case. Nothing particularly profound there. It just says that a creditor of an estate does indeed have standing to make a claim in a probate matter. In our last case here in our written materials, and we'll probably move on to some other ones here in a minute because we went just a little bit faster than anticipated, State v. Ward, supervised release. It's just construing the Minnesota supervised release statute. At this point, first of all, I'm just going to look and see if I have any questions, and no, I don't. And I just need to bring up on my computer here some other recent cases. And we'll look at a couple of other ones since we have a few minutes from outside the region. And these are not in the written materials that you have in front of you. But if you want to see these case summaries, go to my main website, richardclem.com, and then you will see a link there, something along the lines of summaries of recent appellate cases. That's what we'll be looking at. What we'll look at is a couple of interesting cases decided by some of our neighboring states. one of which is actually similar to a Minnesota case. In fact, we'll look at it in more detail Monday. But the one case that was handed down recently was, let's see if I can find it. Irby, State versus Irby, is a Minnesota case. So it was decided on July 2nd. And this is a case where in 2011, Hennepin County District Judge Patricia Kerr-Karasov was suspended by the Minnesota Supreme Court because she was a judge in Hennepin County District Court, but she didn't reside in Hennepin County, or so the Minnesota Supreme Court found. She resided in Chisago County. She went through the motions, at least, of maintaining residence in Hennepin County, but the court made clear that no, that was you were really a resident of Chisago County, even though you were going through the motions of residing in Hennepin County. Well, the question was, was a trial that she presided over was that a valid trial? And the court, and again, we'll talk about this case in our next summary. The court held that her actions were still valid, and they did not get to something called the de facto official or de facto officer rule. But the de facto officer rule says that somebody is a de facto officer if they if they are not qualified, their actions continue to have effect. Now, in this case, they didn't get to that because they construed the statute in such a way to say that, well, no, technically she's still a judge even as long as she resides in the state of Minnesota. So they actually didn't get to the de facto officer rule. But in a case handed down a week later from the Iowa Supreme Court, the de facto officer rule was applied and construed. And before we get to that, I better give you the de facto code number. Code number 3 is A317. A317. A317 is the third code word. In this Iowa Farm Bureau Federation versus Environmental Protection Commission, a case from the state of Iowa, here the there were two issues in the case, but one of them was that official de facto officer rule, because this was a rulemaking by the Iowa Environmental Protection Commission. They have a rulemaking authority, and they proposed some water rules, and the commission voted on these rules, and they passed by one vote or something. Well, one of the commissioners had recently been appointed by the governor of Iowa, and she was confirmed by the Iowa State Senate. Her name was Carrie LeSueur, and she was appointed to that board. Less than a month later, like less than 2 months later, she moved to Montana. And as you might expect, somewhere in the Iowa code, it says that if you're serving on a state commission, you have to be a resident of the state of Iowa. We're not going to have out-of-state people serving on our public boards. It sounds kind of reasonable. So she moved. She up and moved to Montana. And unlike the judge in Hennepin County, she didn't even go through the motions of pretending that she was still an Iowa resident. You would think at least she would, keep an apartment or keep a mailing address or something in Iowa. But no, she moved to Montana, and she promptly got a Montana driver's license, and she promptly registered to vote in Montana. But even after doing those things, she continued to serve on the Iowa Environmental Protection Commission. The Iowa Supreme Court said, no, you're not supposed to do that because you have to be an Iowa resident to serve on this board. But then the question is, what about the validity of the actions she took? What about this rulemaking petition that had passed by a single vote while she was a member of the commission? What do we do about that? Here the court had to apply this de facto officer doctrine. So even though she was unqualified by virtue of the fact that she had absented herself from the state, and what was she thinking? You know, for heaven's sake, you know, what a mess, you know, somebody's going to create when they do something like that. And like I say, she didn't even go through the motions. You know, you would think she could, you know, at the very least, she could say, well, I didn't make that final decision to move until later on. You know, my husband was residing there because he got a new job in Montana, and I decided to stay an Iowa resident, and I kept my Iowa driver's license, and I kept an apartment in Iowa. And even though I was visiting my husband on occasion, you know, at least if you've got to do something like that, you should, you know, kind of go through the motions to do it. So what was she thinking? You know, how can I, you know, when she was participating in that board meeting, via conference call from Montana, knowing full well that she had a Montana driver's license, what was she thinking? But, you know, I don't know. I can't answer that. But in any event, she did do that. And then one of the groups aggrieved by this rule that they passed, they appealed that, and it wound up in the Iowa Supreme Court. There was another commissioner they had some issues with. They said, well, this other commissioner had a conflict of interest. And they said, well, conflict of interest, that's not so big a deal when you're dealing with rulemaking. So that's really not a problem, you know, they had to grapple with the issue of this commissioner who was you know, a resident of the state of Montana at the time she acted, you know, clearly acting you know, ultra vires her authority. I don't know if that's the right word to apply to it, but anyway, so the question was, well, was she a de facto commissioner? She was not a de jure commissioner at that point, but was she de facto? You know, you can tell that the decision is a little bit result oriented because you know, the court, they don't want to throw out all this rulemaking that's taken place in this intervening time because what a mess that's going to cause. So I guess you can't really blame them. They're going to be a little bit predisposed to say that the actions of these boards were valid, just like the Minnesota case. The Minnesota Supreme Court was obviously predisposed to find that they didn't want to throw out all these otherwise valid convictions that came up over this technicality. So here the Iowa Supreme Court similarly looked at this de facto officer doctrine, saying, you know, she was carrying out her duties. She was not qualified, but she was duly appointed. It had never been brought to anybody's attention, so that therefore validates the action she took without legal authority. But there were three judges dissenting from that decision, one of whom, you know, I used the word technicality. They said, well, no, that's not a mere technicality. You know, we're not, there's a reason why, you know, members of our government have to be residents of the state. We're not going to, you know, no matter how qualified we think somebody is, you can't elect an out-of-state resident to be your governor, and the governor can't appoint out-of-state people to serve on these boards. So like I say, two looks at that de facto officer rule. I guess the last case we'll take a quick look at is another one decided a couple of days ago by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The Board of Regents versus Decker, and Mr. Decker, he was a student at somewhere in the University of Wisconsin system, and he didn't like how they were all the fees they were charging. So he started bringing this to the attention of his public officials and exercising his First Amendment rights and so forth. He carried it a little bit too far, and he was disrupting meetings, and he was messing up papers on the chancellor's desk, and he was causing all kinds of problems. So he got himself suspended. Somewhere in the statutes, it says that if you're suspended as a student, you're not allowed on campus. He showed up on campus for a basketball game, but then he kept distributing literature, talking about these student fees. Finally, the Board of Regents said enough was enough, so they went to get a harassment restraining order. And there's a link here in my materials to the Wisconsin statute for harassment restraining orders. As you probably know, we have a Minnesota harassment restraining statute. And if somebody is harassing you, you can get a harassment restraining order. So the issue was, two issues in the case. First of all, can the Board of Regents, are they a person within the meaning of that statute? Do they have standing? Can they be the plaintiff? And they held that yes, they could. The reason why this case found its way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court was that the Court of Appeals had looked at it and said, well, wait a minute. The harassment statute says that you have to engage in harassment, but number two, there can't be any legitimate purpose for your harassment. And they said it was harassment, but he had a legitimate purpose, namely exercising his First Amendment rights. So based on that, the Court of Appeals threw it out. They said he can't get a harassment restraining order. You have to use some other remedies. Well, the university brought that up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They agreed to take it. And they basically held that, arguing about student fees, that's a legitimate thing to be doing. But we have to kind of look at this under a time, place, and manner analysis. Here he was clearly not doing things in the right time, place, and manner. So for that reason, he could be subject to a harassment restraining order, and they reinstated the order that was adopted by the circuit court in Dane County. Although interesting, where do you have jurisdiction over that? Because all this had taken place he showed up on virtually every campus of the University of Wisconsin, and they filed it in Dane County because that's where the Board of Regents were located. Well, at this point, we're up at the top of the hour. We have about 2 minutes left for questions. I'm going to go ahead and give the fourth and last code number, which is A422. So that's our last code number. And at this point, if you have a barking dog, you might want to silence it right now because I'm going to unmute everybody. Yeah, I'll just pause in case anybody has any questions. Well, hearing none, I do want to thank you all for joining us today. Like I say, I'll repeat that last code number. It's A422. Like I say, whether or not you're taking the program live today as part of the conference call or podcast, please, at the conclusion of the program, just email me the four code numbers that you heard during the program. Just email me the code numbers you heard during the program. My email address, it's on my website, but it is Clem, C-L-E-M, dot law, L-A-W, at USA.net. Clem.law@USA.net. And like I say, that I'm going to...
conference muted.
Again for 1 second. The other thing I should mention is that... especially if you're taking this program as part of the podcast, if you have any questions about the program, whether you're a podcast listener or if you're taking it live today, feel free to call me or email me with those. Under the new Minnesota on-demand rules, as well as the Wisconsin rules, I'm available for any questions you have about the program. So if you do have any questions, just shoot me an email, clem.law@usa.net. I promise to answer promptly, probably within the same day. Or give me a call, 612-378-7751, and I can answer any questions that you might have. So thank you once again for joining us today, and I look forward to seeing you at future programs.